deliberations. So where does what I need to know is where that leaves us in terms of an error that was preserved.
Well, and the logic at the time, and you're correct, because throughout the jury instruction in my motion for reconsideration, and I think the government and I think Judge Grady also understood it, if you look at the transcript, he looked at that count one and two were inseparable. So if there was going to be a partial verdict, the partial verdict would have been on count three and hung on counts one and two because they were inseparable. And in fact, I think he makes comments that he was more inclined the night before the whole inconsistency was raised, once we knew what it was, that it was likely going to be a mistrial with respect to one and two. But once that partial verdict was entered where it was on count two, the juror, the head, the foreman asked, well, we have some questions. It's more complicated than that. And Judge Grady said, no, I'm just going to send you back to deliberate overnight again. And so clearly they were having a problem with distinguishing how you can have a hung and a non-unanimous verdict on one, and yet at the same time, when the very first count in count two says finding them guilty in count one. And there was no instruction to clarify that. And it was only until the next morning, while the government argued inconsistent verdict, that this is somehow inconsistent, that Judge Grady began to take a look at it and says, well, now that I've already taken the verdict, but there was no anticipation, and clearly I don't think anyone in the room thought that somehow the jury, given the instructions who the court thought were very clear, could find count two without count one, given the instruction.
Mr. Mitchell, you called the assistant state's attorney, right?
I'm sorry, the assistant U.S. attorney.
You called the assistant state's
attorney? No, I didn't call the assistant state's attorney. The government did.
The government did?
Yes.
And you crossed on the issue of her opinion?
This was the second time that I called. She was called initially with respect to the suppression motion.
Right.
And so her testimony was clear in that regard, and I think, and then she was called as part of the government.
So when did we get to the point where she gives an opinion on his what was you describe the, it?
The question was the completeness of the details
whether
to which
he's
he provided.
Sincere.
I thought it was a fair question.
No, I understand. Was there any objection from the government on that?
Not that I'm aware of, Judge.
You think it's okay to ask her whether he's sincere?
I think it.
Well, I mean, I'm just asking. I just don't ever recall seeing a situation where a prosecutor who took a confession is called to testify, and we get into whether he's sincere.
Well, the reason why it was such an important.
No, I guess I just.
I didn't have anything else, Judge.
No. I'm not being critical of you, Mr. Mitchell. It's interesting that you could get away without any government objection, but we'll see what the government's view of that.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Mitchell.
Thank you.
Mr. Jonas?
That's as honest as it gets. May it please the court, counsel. Starting with the defendant's objection to the jury instructions.
Do you think we could start, instead of that, with what occurred here?
Sure.
I mean, is what, bottom line, is what Judge Grady did the sort of error that you can never really quantify in terms of its impact? And if so, is that a case for deeming the error reversible per se?
I believe the answer is no to both.
I do not understand why what he was doing. Here, it's 8 o'clock, the jurors want to go home, so instead of saying, all right, you come back tomorrow, or he has this long business with the lawyers, and then the jurors come back, and he's pestering them, so they're all confused, and they can't keep counts one and two straight. Well, why did you do that?
Judge Grady did not.
Did you want it? Did you guys want it? Want him to?
No, Judge.
Why didn't you just say,
you objected?
Let them go. They're tired. It's 8 o'clock. Then come back tomorrow. Or Monday. I don't know if this was Friday.
It wasn't a Friday.
It was. Okay. Come back tomorrow.
We did object, and we did request that the court not do what it did. And Judge Grady did not explain why he was taking the partial verdict. I think more importantly is the defense didn't object to it either. And even though he took the partial verdict, that is not harmless error. The government cites the Peake case where a partial verdict was taken, and I believe this court said while that was not advisable, it still wasn't justification for overturning the conviction in that case, and I think the same holds here.
Could the trial on counts 1 and 2 have been severed?
I'm sorry?
Could the trial on counts 1 and 2 have been severed?
Sever those two counts? They could have, in that there's no requirement for count 2, the 924C, to have the underlying predicate act be based upon a conviction of the underlying predicate act. So it's possible, theoretically, that they could have been severed, that just judicial economy would have called for otherwise.
I mean, given the interrelationship between the two, I would have thought the answer would be no.
That's why I'm saying legally there's case law out there that states that in order to convict on the 924C, you do not have to have a conviction of the underlying predicate act, and there's cases that state you don't even have to charge
underlying
predicate.
But what's so strange about this, he confessed to the carjacking.
He confessed to every element except the element of intent.
Not intent separate from intent to harm?
Correct. He did not state during his confession later that day.
What's the difference between 1 and 2 then? Maybe I misunderstand.
Between counts 1
count
and
2?
Well, count 2 incorporates the element of count 1. He has to have committed the carjacking and then adds the extra element that he carried a gun in furtherance of.
Yes, so count 1 is simple carjacking.
Correct.
But he confessed to that, didn't he?
He confessed, except one of the elements of count 1 is that he has to have the conditional intent at the time he's taking the car to cause death or seriously bodily injury.
Well, that's part of 1?
It's part of 1 and 2, because it's part of...
What's the difference between 2? I'm lost. What's the difference between 2 and 1 if the, you know, this conditional intent to harm is part of count 1?
There is no difference between 2 and 1 other than the extra element for count 2.
What's the extra element?
That he was carrying a gun as part of the carjacking. That makes
The gun. It's just the gun. That's the only thing it took.
Correct.
Okay. I forgot.
And I think it's in
right.
Going to the defendant's first argument of the sufficiency of the evidence, what it really boils down to was the evidence sufficient for the jury to come to the conclusion that the defendant did have that intent? And in this case, the defendant there's evidence in the record.
But of course, what's puzzling is I don't understand why a judge isn't allowed to question a jury and say, look, you know, I can't figure out what were you thinking? How could you acquit on, or how could you be uncertain about one and certain about two? Right? That makes no sense.
While this is
judges aren't allowed to ask that, right?
They're not.
They're not. That's some medieval, you know. But then how are we supposed to figure out whether this is a rational jury?
You're not. While if I can expand on that. While this is not technically an inconsistent verdict because there was no verdict for count one.
Right. Why did you argue that it was?
We looked to the principles of inconsistent verdicts because we didn't want the judge to instruct the jury that they were required to convict on count one in order to convict on count two. That would be an improper statement of the law. So looking to the principles in the Powell case, the court there
but
said...
But an instruction of that sort is just insane.
The instruction that they must find on count one. Guilty on count one.
To say that you don't have to find guilt of count one or to find guilt of count two. What's wrong with that is that count one is included in count two, right?
Correct.
Count two is just the gun. So how can you tell the jury, oh, you don't have to find guilt of count one in order to find guilt of count two? What would a rational person think who's told that?
The jury was not instructed that, and no one was asking the judge to instruct the jury that. It was the reverse. The defense, after the verdict came back, was asking the judge to instruct the jury that they must convict on count one in order to convict on count two. And that's an improper statement of the law. The Young case.
Why? Because there's no rational basis for not convicting on one if you convict on two, because one is included in two.
And to that, I turn back to the Powell case, where the court said juries sometimes split verdicts. It could be for a number of reasons, leniency, compromise, and that the courts are not to look behind an inconsistent verdict to overturn the conviction. In order to, the conviction, and I think there was the Peake case that this court held, the conviction.
I mean, you think in a rational system of justice, if a jury does something which indicates irrationality, you would question the entire verdict.
But the case,
say, these people are not thinking with their brains, because somehow they've missed the point that one is totally included in two. So there's no way you can be innocent of one and guilty, or not proved guilty of one and guilty of two.
We don't know what the jury was thinking. We don't know why the jury did what they did.
But it's so irrational.
And I apologize for sounding like a broken record, but I come back to the Powell court that said, and there's a string of cases that we cited in the government's brief that all state the same thing. And in an inconsistent verdict, and this isn't technically inconsistent, but looking to those principles, you leave the...
Well, what do you think the jury was thinking?
In the record, the foreperson sent a note back to the judge on the last day and stated that the jury was 11-1 to convict.
Yeah, that's the situation. You had a hung jury. Mr. Mitchell had successfully reached, with his argument, the jury. So if that's true, then it's how can we get to the second count?
The one person, the one holdout, the note stated something to the effect of that person. We believe that person is not doing their duty. I'm paraphrasing.
Well,
we don't know what that one juror was thinking. We don't know if that juror decided, I want to compromise, convict on one and acquit on the other.
Or may have known that holding up one would cause the problem we have.
Right.
Maybe it's that kind of a
maybe that was the one rational juror.
I would disagree with that, Your Honor. I think the other 11 were rational. But having said that, the case law instructs us we're not to disturb that and not to question.
Well, if I were guessing, what I would say is that the 11 said to 12, okay, you don't want to convict on one, that's fine, but look, two, that's a gun. That's dangerous. So why don't you go along with us on two?
I don't know.
That's the sort of thing you can imagine them doing, right?
I can imagine.
Send a message with guns. We don't like guns.
But even if that's the case, that doesn't mean that.
No, I'm just.
Well, I don't want to speculate as what was going on in the jury room. I wasn't
there. Well, we said in Peake, we didn't encourage this.
No.
So, I mean, I understand you. It's appropriate for you to cite it to us, but it isn't for encouraging district judges to make this move.
And isn't there a possibility that the jury, if they'd been permitted to keep deliberating on all the counts, they might have eventually realized the necessity of agreeing on the offense of carjacking in order to convict on count two, such that it might have hung on count two as well as count one. I mean, look, it's this case is but all of that was aborted. Oh, dear.
If I can briefly...
Jonas, could I just return for a second to the matter that I raised with Mr. Mitchell, because maybe this is what gave some basis to the one as opposed to the 11. Is there any objection to this assessment of sincerity by the government when Mr. Mitchell was successful in drawing that conclusion?
I don't recall at the moment whether or not there was objection. There were several objections during the course of her testimony. I don't recall specifically.
Okay.
My inclination is that there likely was, but I don't. All right. I did focus on that for the purpose of this argument.
Sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, unless there are further questions, I'm out of time, and I would request that the court affirm the convictions for the reasons stated in the government's brief. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Jones. So, Mr. Mitchell, I think the time is right. You can have another minute if you'd like. Do you have anything further?
No, no, yeah? No,
okay. So, Mr. Mitchell, you were appointed, were you not?
Yes, sir.
So we thank you for your efforts on behalf.
Thank you.
We thank Mr. Jonas as well.